Welcome to the Transforming Society podcast. My name is Jess Miles, and today I'm speaking to Bharat Mukhani, Reader in Law at Cardiff University. Bharat's new book, Racial Justice and the Limits of the Law, lays bare the tension between the legal system and the struggle for racial justice. Racial justice is never far from the headlines. The Windrush scandal, the toppling of the statue of Edward Colston, Shamima Begum, and racism within the police have all recently captured the public's attention and generated legal action. But although the ideals of the legal system, such as fairness and equality, seem allied to the struggle, campaigners have been all too often let down by the system. Bharat's book is both a lawyer's guide to anti-racism and an anti-racist guide to the law, bringing together these different perspectives to help both groups understand how to use the law to tackle racial injustices. So welcome, Bharat.
Hi, thanks for having me here.
No, absolute pleasure. It's a really fantastic, interesting book. And I think the relevance probably extends well beyond the law as well, but we'll get on to that. So you start the book with the Colston 4 case. And as we're a Bristol publisher, it felt like this was a fitting place for us to start here. How does this case illustrate the relationship and the paradox between racial justice and the law?
Yeah, so for those who don't remember, back in the summer of 2020, there's a protest in Bristol against racial injustices. And during this protest, several people tear down a statue of Edward Colston. Colston had been revered in Bristol by some people because of his philanthropy in the city back in the 1600s. But he had also been despised by many people because of his role in the trade of enslaved African people. And despite some calls to have the statue taken down, council resisted those calls, and so protesters took their matters into their own hands. And this caused some controversy, to put it mildly. Some people celebrated the removal of the statue, others saw it as an act of vandalism. Now, for reasons that aren't entirely clear, only 4 people are prosecuted for criminal damage, right? And so regardless of whether you approve or disapprove of their actions, one thing is absolutely clear: the legal system is being used against those taking a stand for racial justice. What I found really interesting, though, was how this was all eventually turned on its head. The defense lawyers were really creative and bold. So the law allows a person to commit criminal damage in certain circumstances, such as to prevent a more serious crime from occurring. So to take an example, I could break down the door to a house if I'm trying to rescue people inside from an intruder, for example. And the Colston 4's lawyers argued that the presence of the statue constituted a criminal offence because it was causing distress to people, Black people who had to walk past the statue of a person who was responsible for the enslavement and horrible mistreatment of their ancestors, right? So in other words, the struggle against racism provided Colston 4 with a legal defence for their actions. And the jury acquitted the defendants. We don't know for sure why the jury acquitted the Colston 4. They don't have to give their reasons, but we can assume that they agreed with the Colston 4's arguments. Otherwise, they would have convicted him because there was no doubt about them actually bringing down the statue. That wasn't in question at all. They fully admitted to that. They just said they had good reasons for doing so. And the jury agreed with those reasons. And so, in other words, the legal process ended up furthering the cause of racial justice, as the Colston 4 were deemed to have acted lawfully, right? This jury said that under the law, the fight against racism trumps the law against criminal damage. And so this is the paradox, isn't it? Law can be used to both sustain racial injustices. It can be used against those taking up the cause of racial justice, but it can also be used to tackle racial injustices, like it was in this case. And so that's what I found interesting. That's how, what I thought really exemplified this idea of law's paradoxical relationship with racial justice. And there are loads of other cases, which I sort of peppered the book with throughout. There's lots of cases with law's paradoxical relationship with racial injustice, but you know, I live in Bristol, and this is a case that sort of really spoke to me. And I know it spoke to a lot of people. It was very, very public at the time. I think it's one of the ones that is most widely known. So, yeah, it seemed like a good place to start the book.
So in that particular case, the law did advance the struggle for racial justice. But it feels like more often than not, that doesn't happen. And actually, the law tends to limit the struggle. And I found it really helpful in the book because you use 6 concepts from critical race theory to kind of explain the specific ways in which the law is limiting when it comes to racial justice. So please, could you talk us through these kind of 6 points as a framework for understanding?
Yeah, sure. Critical race theory has come under a lot of criticism itself in recent years, mainly from politicians. But I find that it's a really helpful way of just thinking about racism, right? It's a way of understanding how racism works in any given society. So I think the first point that I make, the first sort of idea of critical race theory is probably at the heart of critical race theory. It's this idea of structural racism, right? So critical race theory, the name is given by American scholars in the 1980s, but actually the ideas behind it were being written about by British scholars in the 50s, 60s, 70s. It was just the name was given to it by American scholars in the 1970s and 80s. And it's just this idea of understanding how racism is more structural than just something that is interpersonal. So what happened in America in the 1960s, you have lots of advances in law in favor of racial justice, right? You have the Civil Rights Act, you have lots of laws being passed to help minoritized people and racialized people to give them legal protections. And that's seen as a big win, that civil rights era. There's lots of decisions of the US Supreme Court, Brown versus Board of Education, where the Supreme Court says that you can't have racially segregated schools. Everyone is equal under the law. Everyone has equal access to schools. So it looks like a lot of the law there is being used to really further the cause of racial justice. Fast forward to the 1980s, and there's still problems, still huge problems with racial discrimination, particularly in the criminal justice system, where Black people in America, in particular, are hugely overrepresented in the criminal justice system. So these scholars started asking why, if we've got the law on our side, why is this happening? And they come up with various explanations. And the same case in England and Wales. You know, we have the 1965, we have the Race Relations Act, we have more Race Relations Acts later on in the 60s and the 1970s. And 1980s and 1990s, people start asking, well, if we've got these laws to protect against racial discrimination, why is it still happening? And the first idea of critical race theory, like I said, is this idea of structural racism. I think for most people, when they think of racism, they think of these sort of interpersonal acts of racism. So the employer who obviously discriminates against a black or brown skinned person, right? Or someone who shouts explicitly racist abuse at a person in the streets. That's clearly racism. And all these laws, the Race Relations Act in the UK, Civil Rights Act in America, lots of these laws were developed to tackle that. And so here in England and Wales, we have a whole host of laws that criminalize acts of racial hatred. So it looks like the law is on our side, if you like, on the side of racial justice. But what critical race theory does is it teaches us that these sort of interpersonal acts of racism are better understood as manifestations or symptoms of structural racism. Right. And I think once we get to grips with this, we see that there are limits in law's capability to tackle structural racism. It might tackle the symptoms of structural racism. It might put a person in prison for an act of racial hatred, but it never tackles the underlying cause, which is structural racism. And I think it's helpful to use an analogy to explain this. I didn't actually use this analogy in my book. Maybe with hindsight, I should have. But think of a house. Right. And you might think of a particular room in that house, like the living room with all its furnishings, the sofa, the curtains, the wallpaper, that sort of things. That's like interpersonal racism. It's the stuff that you can see. It's the stuff that's really easy to tackle if there's a problem. If there's a stain on a cushion, you can clean it. If the table breaks, you can repair it, you can replace it. If a person racially abuses a person, you can arrest them, you can put them on trial, you can punish them. Right. It's the stuff you can see, the stuff that is relatively easy to tackle. But there's more to a house than just the soft furnishings in a room, right? There's the structure to the house, the foundations, the bricks and mortar, the stuff that you can't really see, but it's fundamental to keeping that house upright. And the same with society, right? There are structures in society that are fundamental to keep society functioning, keep society moving, but it's stuff that you can't always see in the background. And likewise, structural racism is the sort of things that it's the argument that racism is actually central to the functioning of society in the same way that the foundation is central to a house, right? But you can't always see it, right? So it's not the visible acts of overt racism, but it's the processes and the cultures that reinforce racial stereotypes and disadvantages. And you can
It's
stretch
the
that analogy
framework,
further. Yeah, it's
the
a framework.
framework that everything's within, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah, it's like the systems, the health system, the criminal justice system, the education system. These are like the gas pipes in a house or the water pipes that run through a house, the stuff that you can't see, but kind of keeps it all functioning. Right. And you can stretch this analogy a bit further. You know, both of them are really difficult to tackle. Tackling subsidence or damp is a lot more difficult than tackling a stained cushion or a broken table, for example. And likewise, tackling structural racism is a lot more difficult than tackling interpersonal acts of racism. There's not always the identifiable person who can be sued or prosecuted or whatever. And so that's where I think the idea of structural racism becomes really helpful in understanding the limits of law and tackling racial injustices. Law really struggles to tackle these sort of unseen problems, these sort of procedural problems, cultural problems that are aligned with structural racism. The second idea is this idea of race as a social construct. So when we look at the history of racism, we see attempts to argue that race is a biological matter, right? And that we are by people of different skin colors are biologically different to each other, and that these differences matter. So scientific arguments, this is particularly in the colonial era where countries are trying to justify colonizing places in Africa and other places and Asia. And they say, well, scientifically speaking, we can prove that darker skinned people are less intelligent, they're physically more unattractive, and that sort of stuff. And so that justifies the use of law to separate the races. So people with dark skin are separate, subject to one set of legal processes and legal norms. People with lighter skin enjoy more favorable legal rights and privileges, right? Yeah. So because Black people are morally and intellectually Blackwards and inverted commas, they can lawfully be enslaved.
Yeah.
Right? It's a lot more nuanced than that, obviously. You remember that, you know, white-skinned people like Jewish people and people of Gypsy, Roma, Traveller heritage have suffered horrendous racism through too for centuries. But that's broadly speaking what happens. And critical race theorists really debunk this. They point out that actually there are no scientific justifications for racism. Yes, we have different skin colors, but it's the same as different colored eyes. There's just no value to attach to these differences.
Yeah.
So if there's no value to attach to these differences, then there's no reason or justification for differential legal treatment. I think that's important because if we can show that the justification for differential legal treatment has been premised on this fallacy, then that might pave the way for tackling racism within the legal system.
Yeah.
Right. So the legal system has a long history of being used to reinforce racism throughout the colonial era. The legal system is used to justify enslavement. It's used to justify the suppression of those who oppose colonialism, right? Really brutal treatment of colonized people. The law is used to deprive colonized people of their land, of their property rights, for example.
Yeah.
And that is all premised on this fallacy that dark skinned people are inferior.
Yeah.
If we debunk that belief, that fallacy, then, you know, that shows that the whole premise of laws racism is unfounded.
Yeah. And I suppose even though like we may not have as obvious laws about those things now, the laws we are governed by hundreds of years old, aren't they, in some cases? So that historical bit really does still have a lot of power, doesn't it?
It does. And one example I give in my book is comparisons between the Criminal Tribes Act of 1871 in India, British ruled India, and today's laws on tackling gangs, right? Gangs in inverted commas.
Yeah.
You know, Criminal Tribes Act, you have a lot of opposition to colonial rule in British India. And so colonial administrators there start deploying scientific arguments that certain Indian tribes, these nomadic tribes, that they're inherently criminal.
Right.
Yeah. These studies, scientific studies, are showing that these nomadic tribes are biologically prone to being criminal. And so that justifies greater monitoring of those tribes, greater use of surveillance powers. And if they do break the law, they're punished to a much greater extent. Right. And there's databases. I mean, British were brilliant at keeping records during colonial rule. They create these databases, and anyone who's born into these nomadic tribes has to be registered with the authorities. And that person is assumed to be a criminal because they're sort of born into this criminal tribe, in inverted commas.
Yeah. Wow. So not much has changed at all, has
Not
it,
much has
in
changed.
hundreds
When
of
we look
years?
at how we tackle so-called gang violence and knife violence and youth violence, tons and tons of studies to show that young black men in particular are overrepresented in the criminal justice system in relation to so-called gang violence. We had the Met's Matrix database, where people were kept on a database and monitored.
Yeah.
And many, many of those had never been convicted of criminal offence at all, not even suspected of a criminal offence. They might have just known someone who had been a suspect in a criminal offence.
Wow.
And that's it. They were on a database. And I think like 80% of people on the database, and perhaps even more, were Black.
Wow.
Joint enterprise, this law that we currently use, where, you know, if a group of people have been involved in a criminal offence and committed a criminal offence, prosecutors don't have to prove who actually pulled the trigger or stabbed the person or whatever. They can just have to show that this whole group of people were loosely involved and all of them are punished to the same extent, right?
Yeah,
And you've got people who weren't even physically present at the scene of crime. They might have just swapped a text message with someone in the hours before and had nothing to do with the crime at all. The text message could have been something completely different, but they're associated with that person now.
and so they can be given the same
And so they can be
punishment.
given the same punishment. Yeah, they
Oh,
can be
wow.
prosecuted. So obviously prosecutors have to prove that there was a connection, but you can
Yeah.
see where the undertones of the racialized undertones of this come into it.
Yes,
And
absolutely.
again, lots of studies that show Black people being hugely overrepresented when it comes to joint enterprise prosecutions.
Yeah, no
But
surprise
there's very
there.
little difference in substance, really, between monitoring, surveillance, and punishment of criminal tribes in British India, the
Yeah.
monitoring, surveillance, and punishment of Black youths in
Yeah.
England and Wales. Do you see?
And it all kind
So
of stems from that
it
race as
all
a
stems
social
from that
construct.
value. So the law today on the database and joint enterprise might not have anything about saying that Black people are inherently criminal,
No.
but the ideas that came from the Indian the Criminal Tribes Act, which did explicitly say brown-skinned people are inherently criminal, the values, the culture, those sort of beliefs and assumptions have sort of infiltrated today's legal order. They've trickled down over the years, over the centuries. People believe that sort of stuff, and it informs their way of acting.
And even though the words in the law aren't necessarily the same, it's structural racism that allows people to apply it in the same way, isn't it? Because it's kind of acceptable to do so. Other things from critical race theory?
So, yep, there's intersectionality, I think, is a very, very
Yes.
key point. And this is where I think the current legal system is really, really inadequate in England and Wales. Racism isn't the only sort of ism, if you like, that's a problem in society, right? There's sexism, ageism, ableism. People are vulnerable to attacks on all sorts of grounds: gender, sexuality, religious beliefs, so on. Law recognizes that, right? The Equality Act prohibits discrimination on the basis of nine different protected characteristics, racism being just one of them. But it sort of silos them off from each other. And activist scholars, again, British scholars probably predated their American counterparts in identifying this. They just never put the name intersectionality. As Claudia Jones talks about this in the early 1900s, Kimberly Crenshaw in America comes up with the name intersectionality, 1980s in America. Sivanandan, British Asian sociologist, have really helpfully explained how people suffer different types of disadvantages in society on the basis of a combination of these personal characteristics. So a Black woman will face different sorts of abuse to a Black man, for example, right? It's this idea that people aren't only persecuted or vulnerable to attacks because of their race, but also their sex, their gender, their age, their disability, their religious beliefs, and so on. But the really important thing that these scholars point out, intersectionalists point out, is that you can't separate these personal characteristics from each other. Right? So it's a bit like, it's again, to take another analogy that I use in the book, I can't remember who I credit this to, but it's another scholar who comes up with this idea of baking a cake. You take all the different ingredients, you bake the cake, and once you've baked the cake, you can't separate out the ingredients. And a human being is like that, right? They can be brown, male, young, disabled. You can't, once you put them together, that's the person. You can't separate these things out from that person, right?
So I'm
And the
guessing
law
this
just can't
relates to
tackle that.
the law can't separate them out. No, the
Yeah,
law does
so
separate them out
the
or
law
tries to
separates them
separate
out.
them
It
out.
tries to separate them out, but it shouldn't. So we have cases where a Black woman says she has been discriminated on the basis of her skin color and her race and her gender, right? She's been discriminated because she is a Black woman, and the law, this case of Baal versus the Law Society, and the court says, well, we have to look at the racial discrimination separately and then the sex discrimination separately, and there should be evidence for both. But she's a Black woman. She's not Black and a woman. She is a Black woman, and that's what you should look at, not
But it
her
becomes
being
two
Black on the
separate
one hand.
processes.
Yeah, exactly. And famous case, Shamim Begum, at the moment, ongoing case that I'm sure a lot of listeners will have heard of. 15-year-old girl, Muslim girl, who is travels to Syria, but we know now she was trafficked. She was duped into joining ISIS. She was vulnerable. It's a 15-year-old girl. She's taken over, and she's found in a refugee camp 4 years later. And, she doesn't regret joining ISIS, but she wants to come back to England because she realizes that there's no way to live. And she's vilified by the British press. She's vilified by the British political establishment. It's very interesting because when you look at the news when she left at 15, when she was 15 years old, there were concerns for her welfare. There were lots of, I think Nicky Morgan, the then education secretary, said, we're hopeful her and her friends who she'd gone with return home safely. And there was concern that these 15-year-old girls had been duped into joining ISIS. 4 years later, she's vilified as a monster. And so the Home Secretary responds to this. Sajid Javid at the time revokes her British citizenship, and that's really major, right? If you think about the rights of citizenship, is one of the most fundamental rights because in a political community, it's that right that allows you to implement your other legal rights. It's the right to have rights. Hannah Arendt famously said that the right to citizenship is the right to have rights. The US Supreme Court has outlawed the deprivation of citizenship because of how severe it is. So the Home Secretary has to say that we can deprive her of her citizenship because she's a threat to national security, but recognition that this is a really serious measure. The law says that you can only do that if that person isn't left stateless.
But she has been left stateless, hasn't she?
In practice, but on paper, because her parents are from Bangladesh, on paper
Bangladesh.
she could have got Bangladeshi citizenship. Bangladesh, remember, came out and said, no, we will not give her citizenship. She's been a member of ISIS, so it's a right on paper only, really, has no practical effect. But the point here is that her case really highlighted the issue of racism here, because you're effectively saying that only those with dual citizenship can be deprived of British citizenship.
Yes,
And
that's
who
what you
has
say
dual
in the book
citizenship,
that I hadn't
right?
thought of
It's,
before in the
yeah, it's
context of her case. It can only be applied to some people.
some people. So if you're white British, you're relatively unlikely to have dual citizenship. If you're brown, like myself, you probably do have access to dual citizenship. I don't. I only have a British passport, but I probably could apply for an Indian passport on the basis of my parental lineage. And so I'm more vulnerable to being deprived of my citizenship than someone who has lived an identical life to me in the UK. I was born and brought up in England and Wales, in England. A white British person can have lived the identical life to me, but they will not be have their citizenship deprived or
There were
revoked.
quite a few moments in your book that made me think differently in that way. So obviously I'm familiar with the Shamima Begum case. I'd thought about her citizenship at all, but I hadn't really thought that that law could only be applied to some people. And also with the Shamima Begum as well, it's this focus on race. And ISIS,
There's a
isn't it?
lot more
Which
to
is
it,
your
yeah.
intersectionality bit.
But
We've
she's
somehow
also,
forgotten all the other aspects
yeah,
of her personality, of
absolutely.
who she is.
Yeah, she is a girl, she is Muslim, and these issues come into play as well. She's, I think, one of the reasons why she's been vilified so much is she doesn't sort of, she kind of goes against the stereotype of that, in inverted commas, demure Muslim wife, that
Being
kind of,
unapologetic and
yeah, exactly, And so all those factors come into play. Her age as well is really vital to this,
Well, and all the dreadful, dreadful experiences she's had as well. And it's just, we're so focused on this one particular legal bit. All of that falls by, it's so easy to discount somehow all the other stuff.
Absolutely. And so she's lost two children while she was out there. Two of her children died of malnutrition, and there are some sections who just sort of see that as a reason that she's a bad mother. And so there's the sexism that comes into play, So I think hers is a really tragic case of how intersectionality plays out in practice. And the Home Secretary just would not see this, just saw her as a monster and didn't realize that actually one of the reasons why she's been portrayed as a monster is because she's been attacked at all these different angles. She's not acting as a woman should, as a brown-skinned Muslim woman should, as a young person should, and so
And here, the legal system has actually prevented her from getting any kind of justice, but racial justice.
exactly. So yeah, so I think that's, for all those reasons, the issue of intersectionality really highlights the limits of the law in a whole string of
Absolutely.
cases.
So we have structural racism, social construct, intersectionality.
Yeah. I think the fourth concept of critical race theory that I think is really interesting for explaining law's relationship with racial justice is this idea of interest convergence. This is an idea put forward by another American scholar called Derek Bell. And he basically looks, he asks himself, remember I said at the beginning, one of the sort of starting points of critical race theorists was, well, if we've got all these sort of successes in the legal system, these acts, these laws being passed, these decisions of the US Supreme Court, how do we explain them when there is so much racism in society, right? If we've got so many examples of the law facilitating racial injustices, how do we explain those occasions when the law seems to be on the side of racial justice?
How do we explain that?
And so Derek Bell comes up with this idea of interest convergence, which, as the name suggests, is when the interests of different racial groups converge. And so a decision or a legal act in favor of ethnic minorities doesn't threaten the interests of the dominant racial group.
Yeah.
So something happens that means that actually it doesn't threaten, or it's actually in the interests of the dominant racial group for this decision to be in favor of racial justice. So to use a British example, take Stephen Lawrence's murder back in 1993.
Yeah.
Very famous case here in England and Wales, obviously. And in the aftermath of his murder, politicians really make this an issue and pass a lot of laws criminalizing acts of racial hatred to make it easier to prosecute people who have committed acts of racial hatred.
Yeah.
Why? Is this just because lawmakers suddenly had a concern for the welfare of Black people in the aftermath of the murder? Or is it because the Daily Mail had taken up this cause, and so politicians knew that they had the support of the Daily Mail's readership, and so, you know, it was in their interest to take action because they would secure the support, or they had the support of the Daily Mail's readership. Think about when the Race Relations Act was passed in 1965, this groundbreaking measure in English law that says racial discrimination is outlawed. It's limited in its scope, but at the time, it's really groundbreaking. It's the first time a piece of law in England, in mainland England, outlaws discrimination. There had been some in the colonies earlier, but this was the first time in mainland England. Why? Is that out of a sudden concern with the rights of brown and black skinned people?
No,
because when we look at the historical context, we see at the same time that the Race Relations Act has been passed, there's a whole host of immigration measures that are wholly contrary to the rights of black and brown skinned people, a whole load of immigration measures that are saying to black and brown skinned people, you are not welcome in England and Wales.
Right.
So what you have here is this trade-off, this kind of like, we're going to make it really hard for you to come to England and Wales, but when you do come here, we'll give you certain rights, right?
Yeah.
But the white British majority were able to swallow the Race Relations Act because they knew that these people were being blocked from coming into England and Wales in the first place, or to Great Britain in the first place.
Wow.
So their interests weren't threatened by the Race Relations Act.
Yeah.
Right. And the debates in Parliament make it clear that it was that latter. You know, they say, well, look, we're going to allow some black and brown skinned people into the country, and to manage race relations, we'll enact these Race Relations Act to just balance out the interests of them with the white British majority who are worried that they're going to come in.
Yeah.
You know, so this idea of interest convergence is this idea that legal progress will only be made when making progress doesn't really threaten the issue of structural racism, for example.
It's important not to look at laws in isolation, but look at everything else that's happening, everything that's happening at the same time.
You know, so again, this goes back to that issue of structural racism. It's very easy to put an outright racist in prison because that doesn't really threaten the interests of the white British majority because structural racism isn't being tackled. Do you see?
So
that's the idea of interest convergence. The fifth concept is the idea of lived theory, which I think is really important. For centuries, you know, from the cases of slavery through to the present day, we often find that in cases involving racialized people, their voices just aren't heard. During cases on slavery, enslaved people were characterized as property for the purposes of legal action, and their voices just weren't heard. They weren't even considered to be human beings. And you have the famous case of Somerset and Stuart, where for years people thought that a case outlawed slavery in the British Isles. It didn't at all. You know, it was just a very narrow ruling. And the judge in that case, Lord Mansfield, there are biographies written about him and what he meant in his ruling, and scores of academic articles pouring over what his judgment meant. Right? The
Can you say
abolitionist.
what the case of Somerset and Stuart is?
Yeah, sure. So Somerset and Stuart, back in the 1700s, a slave owner travels to England from Jamaica, brings his enslaved person with him, James Somerset, and he escapes captivity. He's recaptured, put on a boat bound for Jamaica, but this comes to the attention of abolitionists like Granville Sharp. So they invoke a law that is actually meant for people accused of crimes, the Habeas Corpus Act, saying that anybody who is detained, physically detained, has a right to have their case heard before the courts, right? It can't be arbitrary. There has to be a legal justification for it. And they argued that this applies to people who are enslaved as well. So this person is shackled to a ship, being bound for Jamaica. He has a right to have a to represent his arguments in court. His owner has to present a legal justification for shackling him, right? And Lord Mansfield rules very begrudgingly that, this particular person, there's no legal justification for keeping this particular person shackled to a ship. He's free. Right? Doesn't outlaw slavery, doesn't say anything about slavery per se. It's just in this particular case, there is no legal justification for shackling him. But the cause is celebrated. Abolitionists see this as a victory. It's presented as a victory because this slave is set free, this enslaved person, rather, is set free. Granville Sharp, one of the abolitionists who sort of really leads on this case, there are biographies about him. There's nothing that we know about James Somerset. There's nothing about the actual enslaved person whose bravery in escaping slavery had really won the case. If it was not for him really taking the risk, he's putting his life on the line by escaping slavery.
There's no
But there's
voice at
nothing
all.
about him,
No.
no written word about him at all. It's the judges in the case who are celebrated, or the abolitionists, the white abolitionists who are celebrated, right? And so, we have that from centuries ago where the black people are at the heart of the case, their voices aren't listened to.
Do you think that still happens now?
2015, there's a case, so it's back in 2015, or as recently in 2015,
As
there's a
recently
case
as,
at the
yeah.
UK Supreme Court to deal with stop and search powers of the police. Totally different context to slavery, right? But we have here a person arguing that she was stopped and searched on the basis of her race, and that stop and search powers are racially discriminatory. Right, and there's lots and lots of statistics to prove this. But the court ultimately disagrees with her and says, that although the statistics are there, there's nothing in this particular case to show that she was stopped on the basis of being black. And the court actually says quite explicitly that stop and search powers are beneficial for black communities because it is young black people who are more likely to be victims of knife crime, right? That's what the court says. Lady Hale says that actually stop and search powers are beneficial for black communities because it's black people who are more likely to be the victims of knife crime. And so we need these stop and search powers to protect them. But there is no support for this argument at all. There's no reference to any person saying that, yep, or anything like that. And when you actually look at what black communities think, and when you listen to black people about what they think about stop and search powers and knife crime, there is so much evidence to show that they would prefer a public health approach to tackling knife crime, not a criminal
Course,
justice approach. Because in their eyes, criminal justice approaches, there's just such a lack of trust between black communities and police officers that a criminal justice approach is bound to fail. But a public health approach, a more public education approach about the dangers, that would be preferable. So again, what the UK Supreme Court did there is it just flat out ignored the voices of black communities. It said, we know what's best for you. Stop and search powers are best for you. So
It's
we're
more
gonna
than it's
allow
more
this.
than ignoring, though, isn't it? It's being totally comfortable with speaking for whole communities
Yeah.
without even thinking about it. I mean, I can't say
Exactly.
whether or not the judge thought about it, but it is like these kind of sweeping statements said on behalf of people without possibly even having had conversations with them. And then that
Exactly.
goes back to the structural racism as well. Everything comes back to the structural racism because
That's why I start with it, yeah.
somehow that happens and that's okay and we don't question it because it's all so embedded, isn't it, in all of
It is.
us.
And that goes to the sixth point that I make about critical race theory, which is actually a law as a process, as a system. given all those points, I don't think the law can ever really tackle racial justice adequately or effectively. And because, you know, many legal processes, not all, but many are really adversarial in nature. But racial justice requires sort of, it requires conversation and dialogue. There's a lot in the book about the past, isn't there? It requires sort of teaching and learning about the historical reasons for contemporary issues of racism, Britain's colonial era and the racial injustice of the past. It requires sort of empathy and understanding. People really understand live theory, really understanding someone else's point of view and what they've lived. But adversarial processes, though, tend to involve argumentation and denial, pitting one side against the other, you know, rather than working jointly towards a shared understanding of an issue.
So it's the very nature of how we do law that makes it is going to make it impossible as well.
Absolutely. So what I try and show in the book is how these six concepts have reared their head time and time again, like I said, from the days of slavery right through to the present day, 1500s right through to the present day. And these six issues go a long way to explaining why law has its limits in the struggle for racial justice, because it can't tackle structural racism. It's been part of the process of biological racism, if you like, scientific racism. It's constructed the idea of racism historically. It can't tackle intersectionality, you know, and, you know, it silences the voices of victims of racism a lot of the time.
Gosh, that's really scary and disheartening and worrying, isn't it? That the fundamental structure makes it impossible to do anything about racial injustice. Having said that, you talk a bit in the book about anti-racist lawyering. I think it's something that's possibly a bit controversial, but I wanted to ask you a little bit about that, and I suppose, given everything else, whether it's actually possible.
I think that's, you're right. There was part of me that I didn't want to end the book on a really depressing note, basically. And I thought, I can't give up. You know, I've been studying law for decades now. You know, I just, it's what I do. I didn't want to suddenly come to this realization that actually law is futile or anything like that. I thought there have been cases where legal action has been really successful, like the Colston Fall case. And so I was trying to develop this approach to lawyering that is cognizant of these six concepts of critical race theory, right? Really, it takes into account law's complex relationship with the struggle for racial justice. So it's an approach that recognizes law's limits, but seeks to make the most of these limits, just sort of pushes the limits as far as it can. And so I come up with these sort of four principles that sort of address those six concepts of critical race theory. And so the first is reflection. This really speaks to the idea of structural racism. And I argue that an anti-racist lawyer is someone who constantly reflects on their own biases and prejudices and the ways in which the legal system might entrench racial injustice, right? Because structural racism is so insidious, invidious, that we might not always see it in ourselves. Right, we might not understand when our own actions reinforce structural racism. A lawyer
Or
might
in
not
is that
understand how legal processes have been informed by centuries worth of racism. So it's this idea that if you're going to be anti-racist, you have to always reflect on your position, your position as a lawyer, your actions, your assumptions. And then I think the second principle is that idea of creativity, and this kind of speaks to the limits of the law, right? Law has its limits, but it is also flexible, and the Colston Fall case is a good idea of that. There's nothing in the statute that says the fight for racial justice is a defense to criminal justice, to criminal damage explicitly, right?
No.
It just says that, you know, if you're trying to prevent a more serious crime from occurring. And the defense lawyers were really creative in how they weave the issue of racial justice into the language of that statute. Right? It said that the struggle for racial justice in this case was a defense to the crime of having the statue rather on public display.
Yeah, it's incredibly smart.
Yeah, so it's that creative lawyering. Then the third is this idea of collaboration, this idea again of the limits of law. You know, if law is only ever going to provide a partial solution to any particular issue. If a kid has been discriminated at school on the basis of skin color, then, you know, they might win their case, but they need help getting back into the educational system, don't they? They might not want to go back to that school if their school teachers have been discriminatory against them. And we've seen that, as I state some examples in the book where this has happened. So maybe the lawyer needs to get in touch with an educational specialist to try and get this child back into the system. Yeah, or try to get them to trust teachers again. You know, if you've been discriminated at work, if you've been sacked on the basis of your race or denied promotion on the basis of your race. It's all very well to win your case at an employment tribunal. Great, but are you really going to be able to go back to that workplace?
What happens
Right?
after?
Probably not, exactly. You're not going to trust too. So you might want to work somewhere else, but you're going to be psychologically scarred. So do you need therapy? Do you need an employment agency to help you get back into the workplace who has specialist knowledge of people who've been discriminated at work? So it's really important for lawyers to really recognize that they are not the be all and end all of, they're not going to cure the problem just by winning their case, right? They need to work with other specialists to help that person. And then the fourth is this idea of accountability, and that speaks to the issue of live theory, this idea that, lawyers are the professional, they're the ones with legal skills, sure, but it's the person who suffered racism who has expert knowledge of what has happened, really. They're the ones who are at the heart of the case, and so they have to be listened to constantly. And like you said, I think there'll be a lot of people who read this who think, no, it's not, that's totally wrong. A lawyer is a lawyer. They shouldn't be anti-racist or anything like this. They just have to apply the law, right? The law fears and favors nobody. It applies equally to all. If a racist, an outright racist person wants to invoke their legal rights, the lawyer is bound to defend them because even they have legal rights. And that might seem antithetical to anti-racist law because, if you're defending a known racist, then you're not exactly promoting anti-racism, are you? I accept that the professional ethics duties come first. And yes, even racists have legal rights. Of course they do. Everybody has legal rights. But I just think that anti-racist lawyering is this idea of just having that mindset when you're acting, of always bearing in mind your personal, professional prejudices, the way the system works, and having your client at the heart of the case, but recognizing the limits of law, just being as creative as you can do. So yeah, I think anti-racist lawyering is possible, just if you accept that it has its limitations.
I mean, if you acknowledge that it's the system and the process that can make racial justice worse, you have to provide some balance to that, don't you? So it's not just about being anti-racist, it's about doing things that create more of a balance, I suppose, as well. Those ideas of like reflection, creativity, collaboration, and accountability, I think are really interesting and important because it enables us, those of us who aren't involved in the law, to kind of think about what we do and how we can like apply these ideas to the structures and processes that we work in. And I had like something that I wanted to ask you about equity, diversity, and inclusion work following reading your book, because we try and do that kind of thing at Bristol, and I'm involved in a bit of that, and I expect it's the kind of thing that our listeners might be involved in too. And I found your discussion, there's just one bit in the book where you talk about the language of it, and I found it really interesting, especially around the terms equality, equity, diversity, and inclusion, and how they're actually problematic. And it made me think about how there are structural limits in place everywhere, like not just in the law, like probably in every organization that we're in, these are appearing somehow. I just wondered if you could say something quickly about those
Like you
words
said,
and what we should think about.
I think, like you said, everyone will have heard the terms equality, diversity, and inclusion. Practically all workplaces and organizations speak of their commitment to those terms, right? But I think the problems with these terms is that they're well-intentioned, but they inadvertently maintain the status quo, right? And I'll explain what I mean by that. So you can take each of those terms in turn, if you like. So take equality. Well, equality implies that everyone has the same starting position and they should be treated equally, right? They're on a level playing field, treat everyone as though they're on a level playing field. But that doesn't reflect social reality, right? People have very different starting points in life on the basis of all their different isms, like I said, of their gender, their class, and their race. Right. And so it's this idea that, some people will need a bit of a help getting to an equal position with those who've had a more advantageous start in life. Diversity, right? But diverse from what? When a company says they'll respect diversity, what are they respecting diversity from? Yeah.
Diversity from something.
Diversity from something. That answer is the status quo. They're saying that we have a working culture, but we'll accept people who are diverse from that working culture. And that's a bit of a problem because it sort of centers this idea of of whiteness, if you like, right, for want of a better phrase. This idea that, okay, we have our working culture that has been informed by centuries of racial discrimination and racial prejudices and so on. We respect diversity from that, but it still keeps that at the center. And inclusion is the same. We'll include you in our spaces. But what are those spaces? Yeah.
Who owns
What
those
if those spaces
spaces?
are problematic, right?
That's kind of what came over, because I'm really interested in this stuff. So that really came over from your book. It's like all this stuff we do and we think we're doing good things, and but actually, because of the structural racism, perhaps we are also perpetuating things at the same time, and we need that creativity, accountability, reflexivity, collaboration to, we should all be doing that, to all like really critique and look at what we're doing. And I don't know what the, I don't know how to do it differently yet, but
Yeah,
I'm sure there's a way.
I make a loose suggestion in the book. It's only a passing reference, but I think rather than speaking of sort of a diverse and inclusive workplace, we should speak of a sort of an intersectional workplace,
That
one
was it,
that sort of thrives on the positives of different worldviews, if you like, you know. And the idea that, you know, our workplace, rather than saying our workplace is inclusive and diverse, right, just say our workplace is intersectional. We will take on, we really thrive off the different perspectives that people bring from their different backgrounds, their different personal characteristics, you know, make it a more positive thing.
Which is nice as well, because that focuses on what people do in the workplace,
Yeah, on what
rather
people can
than just
bring.
who's in your workplace.
Yeah, on the values that people bring to the workplace.
Thank you. That was a really, really massively jumped out at me as I was reading, even not as a law person, but so I have one last question, and you've spoken to it a bit already. It's really that looking for a bit of hope in all of it. You quote James Baldwin in the introduction to the book, where he says, "Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced." So, if we're concluding that the law is really too limited to achieve racial justice, what is there to learn, and are there any places where change can be made, do you think?
Yeah, so what is there to learn is the idea of anti-racist law, and it's that idea of, okay, let's make the most of these limits, right? But
Oh,
law is
that's a
just
good
one
way of phrasing
arena.
it. Yeah.
Law is just one arena where the struggle for racial justice is fought. I haven't seen it yet, but I was reading about a new TV documentary called Defiance, which I think was on a couple of weeks ago. It
Okay.
traces how South Asians really organized against racism in 1970s, 1980s England, British Asians. You know, they took to the streets and protest, and protest is a powerful place to force political change, you know.
You think that it still
Education,
is?
yeah, it still is. I think it
Yeah.
still is. Yeah,
Good.
that's one reason why there's such a clamp down on the right to protest, because
True. Yeah.
politicians recognize the power of protest.
Yeah.
Education, I don't just mean in schools and colleges, I just think in workplace training as well. Having leadership from the top, private companies can change their policies and their processes, for example. So in Wales, you know, I'm at work at Cardiff University in Wales at the moment. The Welsh government has this anti-racism action plan, and right from the very top, government agencies are saying, right, we are going to really tackle structural racism head on in criminal justice and education and healthcare and all these places, right? And they're making an effort to change their policies and processes, and you know that's without regard to the law. You know, they're not thinking, "Do are we just doing what we're legally obliged to do?" They're going beyond that, and that's because of leadership from the top, right? So it's that kind of cultural change that we need. So I think another way of thinking about it is maybe law is better understood as a last resort. You know, we make resort to law when changes on the streets, in politics, in schools, in workplaces haven't succeeded. Then we invoke the law, right? But you know, I'm wary of that being pessimistic.
But
You
then
know,
also the law can be invoked in different ways, like we've seen with the Colston 4 case, can't it? And with that creativity, maybe there is space for
yeah.
adapting it and using it, using
I
the
think,
law that
yeah,
there is in better ways.
there's another quote by James Baldwin, which I, with hindsight, I should have put in the book, actually. It would have been nice to end the book with it, seeing I started with one. James Baldwin, the quote is, "I can't be a pessimist because I am alive. And to be a pessimist means you have agreed that human life is an academic matter. So I'm forced to be an optimist." It's this idea that, you know, if you're a pessimist, didn't you, what's the point of doing anything? You've basically given up on life. You have to be an optimist if you want to live life. And I think that's why I end the book with these ideas for anti-racist lawyering and that kind of, just to inject a bit of hope in it. I'm still optimistic that law can be used to achieve racial justice in certain circumstances. And I'm totally supportive of people using the law whenever they can. But I just think it speaks to that point about collaboration. It's just, I think sometimes there's a danger that lawyers and academic lawyers think only of the law, and they don't realize that actually law is just one arena, and we need to work in collaboration with politicians, with campaigners, with people on, with other people, with educational experts, with healthcare experts, and all those people.
And that's how things will change. I think that's a fantastic point to end on. And thank you, because it's an incredibly thought-provoking book. Like I say, even for those of us who don't feel, well, that's daft, because we're all involved in the law, aren't we, all the time. But even those of us who don't consciously think about the law a lot, it's really, really interesting. So thank you for speaking to me.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Racial Justice and the Limits of the Law by Barrett Malkani is published by Bristol University Press and is out now. You can find out more about the book on our website, bristoluniversitypress.co.uk, and you can also get 25% off all our books by signing up to our mailing list. Thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, please follow us wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you, Barrett. It's been a pleasure and really, really
Thank you.
interesting. Thank you.